Introduce yourself, please.
Erin Davis.
From?
From Olathe.
We'll get more into that in just a minute. Here comes the open. This is Statehouse Blend. I'm Sam Zeff. We're using coffee and donuts to help us better understand the historic legislative session underway in Topeka. The issues and the people in the Kansas legislature. Here we go. And joining Erin and me this morning in the KCUR production studio is Christopher Leach from Merriam, Kansas. Christopher, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure.
And my KCUR colleague, Dan Margulies, who runs our Heartland Health Monitor Desk. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
All right. I thought it was going to be kind of an easygoing summer in the world of state government in Kansas. Turns out that is just a huge falsehood. It's going to be pretty busy. We're going to get into a couple of things about what's hanging out there right now. But first, Erin, my two favorite questions. Tell me about your kids and your pets and how you ended up in the state house.
Well, I have 13-year-old twins, son Luke.
Well, you're a better person.
I have a son, Luke, and my daughter, Isabel, who's actually in the studio with us this morning observing. Pets, we have a Yorkie Shih Tzu mix, Gracie, and a brand new puppy, a bulldog named George.
Wow. So you are busy. Twins, two dogs. So what got you into politics?
You know, politics has been a love of mine probably since I was in junior high school. And I don't really know what flipped the switch to turn that interest on. I remember sitting in a government class thinking this is really fascinating and talking about the separation of powers and how that works. So I began to get involved volunteering with campaigns at a young age. And there was an opening in our district when Representative Bob Montgomery stepped down. And so I was appointed in January 2014 through a special election. And then last November, general election, I won that.
Right. So. And remind me which district? Remind everybody what district you are
from? It's District 15 in Olathe. We cut right through the center core of Olathe. So the beginning, the northern edge of that district is 119th Street. We go clear through the middle swath of Olathe to 56 Highway, approximately.
All right, a couple things that I want to talk about today. The Gannon school funding case, we're going to talk about that. Same-sex marriage, but first I'm going to take our first trip around the table and see what's on everybody's mind. Dan Margulies, what's on your mind?
Well, let me ask the representative this. You're a lawyer, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so I feel compelled to ask you about this whole dust-up involving Representative Valdinia Wynn of Kansas City, Kansas, and just to remind our listeners, this was over remarks she made during a March Education Committee hearing regarding a bill that would have repealed a 2004 law allowing undocumented students to pay resident tuition at state universities. And she called it a, quote, racist, sexist, fear-mongering bill. And you headed a committee, if I'm not mistaken, that looked into a misconduct complaint brought by, I believe it was 9 members of the House Education Committee. That hearing that was held a couple of weeks ago, I believe, was a wild and woolly affair, right, with lots of people coming out to support Representative Wynn. In the end, your committee decided to dismiss the complaint. You abstained from voting. Why?
I was not in agreement with the dismissal of the complaint.
Could you elaborate?
I'd like to go back and talk a little bit about how we got to the hearing process, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
To sort of lay the groundwork. The Select Investigating Committee is a thing of both statute and House rules. And House rules require, not allow, but require that the Speaker of the House appoint a Select Investigating Committee when a formal complaint is filed with the chief clerk. So that happened at the end of March, subsequent to the Education Committee meeting in question. Once that was filed with the chief clerk, the speaker at that point has no choice. It is not a may, it is a shall. And I think that that's one big misnomer, that the speaker himself was going after her. And that's not it. It's just that it is, and it's how the law reads. So once that was established, the speaker asked me if I would be willing to chair that committee. keep in mind, this is my second session. I've not chaired a committee ever. I'm not a vice chair of a committee. So, but was I up for the challenge? Sure. I'm not going to look a challenge in the face and turn it down. So I agreed. And my main concern was to keep all the proceedings very respectful for all persons involved. The complainants that felt wronged by the words that were spoken in the committee meeting, as well as Representative Nguyen, we're all elected officials. We all have constituents, at least 51% thought that we were the best people for the job. And so the amount of respect that I wanted to allow for all of us was really at the top of my list of things that I wanted to accomplish with the committee. Having said that, Representative Nguyen did hire a fairly high-profile attorney who made all sorts of interesting accusations about the proceedings and whether or not I was denying her a right to counsel and things like that. The simple fact is that there was no right to counsel that's in the statutes allowed. And, you know, I advised him that, of course, she could hire any attorney. She could get counsel from that attorney. The attorney could be present with her, but the attorney was not going to be part of the proceedings because this was a sort of a family discussion, if you will. Per our constitution, we are a self-regulating body when it comes to discipline. And so the only persons that I was interested in hearing from and precedent, as well as statute backed this up, was the representatives themselves. So that was sort of the undercurrent of how we walked in. I received over 2,000 emails, hundreds of phone calls. He released my personal information. So there was lots of pressure going into this. When we went into executive committee, I will not discuss what was said there, but the majority of the members did not believe that the comments that Representative Nguyen made rose to the level of recommending a formal punishment. I, on the other hand, having studied Mason's rules, which is a rule book that we follow in the legislature, there is a whole entire chapter about decorum during debate. And in that chapter on decorum during debate, it talks extensively about impugning the motives of other members. And the difference was that Representative Nguyen's comments weren't just directed toward the bill. They were directed toward the supporters of the bill, and she called them racist and bigots and sexist. I believe that that crossed the line. I do believe that that was impugning the motives of the people on that committee that supported it. And, you know, one of the things that we deal with in the legislature all the time is very controversial matters. And being able to do so while keeping decorum and respect for those who may differ with us in our views on a particular topic is of the utmost importance. And so when one of the representatives made a motion to dismiss, I was not going to vote against that formally, but I was not going to vote for it. And traditionally, the chairperson does not vote unless to break a tie. So it was a 5-0 vote.
Is there any opportunity for you as a chair of such a committee to say to the complaining individuals, look, you're in politics, develop a thicker skin. So somebody chose their words poorly. Do you have to go boohoo and say my feelings were hurt because she called me names? And let's just move on with business here. Did it have to reach this level because a few people didn't like how they were being spoken to?
You know, that's an interesting question. And I think I sort of took a different perspective on what my role was. My role as the committee chairperson was not to persuade either side. You know, equally, I could have gone to Representative Nguyen perhaps and said, look, what you said was out of line. Could you please go and apologize and ask them to dismiss the complaint? That wasn't my role. You know, from the very first time that we met, I told the media and requested of my committee members, I'm not making this a media circus because that's not the role of this committee. So it wasn't my place to go to either the complainants nor Representative Nguyen and ask them to do anything other than comply with the rules that I had established for the committee. Whether or not leadership wished to go and make that appeal, it was up to leadership, and you would have to have the speaker on your show to ask him that question.
Sam's got that call in, I'm sure.
Actually, we do have that call in, quite frankly. All right, we're going to move on here. So a few days after the Supreme Court said same-sex marriages are legal everywhere, Governor Brownback issued an executive order. Here's part of his statement. We'll listen to that. We'll talk about it on the other side.
Religious liberty is at the heart of who we are as an American people and as Kansans. This right is the right that the founders came over in search of when they started this country.
All right, so the executive order goes on to say that the state of Kansas cannot discriminate against a religious organization who chooses not to recognize a same-sex marriage. Under the governor's statement, he said this protects clergy people, religious organizations that may do service or may provide services, homeless shelters, adoption services, that sort of thing. Before I get into anything, I want to hear your thoughts about the executive order. Do you think it was needed?
Policy wise, I don't believe that the executive order was needed. Politically, I do understand that a significant portion of our constituency in Kansas believes in the traditional definition of marriage being between a man and a woman. So I do believe it was probably appropriate for the governor to say, look, in Kansas, we still believe in freedom of religion. And if you have a deeply held religious belief that says that marriage is between a man and a woman and you don't wish to be a part of that ceremony, we're just going to sort of highlight the portion of freedom of religion and say you don't have to. You know, as an attorney, I'm quite well aware there's, you know, nothing that would compel a member of the clergy to be involved. That already exists. If I were to get married again, which I'm already married, so, you know, then, but set that aside, if I were to, you know, be Jewish and want to marry, you know, someone who was not of the Jewish faith, that rabbi does not have to perform that ceremony. I mean, we already have instances such as this where the confines of a particular religion would dictate what is appropriate and what that religion wishes to solemnize.
Which suggests that the governor's executive order was gratuitous. It really had – there was no need for it,
you're saying. Those are your words. Those aren't my words.
Right.
Well, but
it does have the force of law, though.
I mean, it's not like he just issued a statement. He issued an executive order that has the force of law, and I think that elevates it to a different level. I mean, do you agree or not agree?
I agree that it elevates it to another level, and I've already said that I don't believe that it was absolutely necessary for him to do. Having said that, I know that the ACLU and Equality Kansas, I believe, is the other group that is sort of trying to figure out how far the tentacles would reach on this executive order, which I think is what you were alluding to with the homeless shelters and the adoption agencies and all that. And honestly, we don't know that, Sam. I mean, at this point, we don't know how far those tentacles reach. So will it be challenged in court? You know, yeah. And I would guess that, you know, that's going to be true not just in Kansas. That's going to be true across the United States. I mean, the Supreme Court's ruling even recognized some of these challenges that were getting ready to come in front of us. So I don't know that we can sit here and say it will be because of Governor Brownback's executive order. I really think it's the nature of the beast that there's a lot to be figured out. I practice family law. The partner of my firm and another associate and I had a meeting this week, you know, talking about what does it look like now? Mm-hmm. You know, what is the date of marriage? Right? What is it? Is it something that existed forever? Because we're looking at the fact that we're going to have people who are going to now be getting divorced that are same sex and, you know, maintenance calculations. I mean, it just sort of the ripple effect of the Supreme Court's decision is not something 2 weeks out we're going to have any idea of where this is headed.
Which begs the question, as an openly gay man in a committed relationship of 24 years who's had to cobble together a legal structure to protect our property and our interests one on another. And we're still not planning on getting married right now because the atmosphere owing to gestures like the governor's is still one of opposition and antagonization and disenfranchisement. I don't know why it was necessary for the man who was elected to lead our state to take a stand against enfranchisement and inclusiveness and welcoming citizens to live in this state and have happy, productive lives when the Supreme Court of our country has said, you know, we know this is a contentious issue, but this is where our country is, and this is how we feel the rights of all citizens are going to be protected. This gesture to protect religious liberty is superfluous and gratuitous, in my view, because no one's religious liberties are being challenged or questioned. There isn't a proposition by a state senator to stone and execute Christians in Kansas now. There isn't an effort on the part of politically active churches to say that God hates Christians and is going to kill them because they're responsible for the downfall of American civilization. It's a class of people who have been specifically targeted who are now being included in the great umbrella of American citizenship. And it's really demoralizing and so disappointing that someone as intelligent and as experienced as Mr. Brownback is should make this gesture to yet again grind his heel on the necks of Kansas citizens. It's really, really disappointing. And I appreciate your thoughtfulness, and you seem like a very rational and deliberate individual.
Nobody ever says that about me, by the way, but you're absolutely right about Aaron.
I was gesturing at Representative Davis, not Mr. Neff. We want the record to reflect that. But it's just another signal that the fight for equal rights for all citizens in our secular country is not over, and there's a lot of work to be done to make sure we're all benefiting from the same protections.
That's a very harsh statement that Christopher just made. I don't call into question that's your reality, but what do you think? I mean, you know, this notion that that some think that this is a way of Governor Brownback trying to demoralize a certain segment of the population in Kansas. What do you think about that? Because if you read, you know, and this saddens me, right? I'm a Kansas guy, you know, and so when I read something and there was an editorial in the LA Times today about Kansas, and when I read that there is this sort of pervasive mean-spiritedness in Kansas, that we're intolerant, this is not the Kansas that I know. It's not the Kansas that you know. I don't think so. What do you think about that? When you hear that about our beloved home state?
You know, we've heard that a lot about our state, not only with this most recent executive order, but I think more broadly, our tax policy.
Yeah.
And so it's not something that's different. What I would say is that I know Governor Brownback fairly well, and he is a good man with a kind heart. And I do think the statements that he made that were contained both within the executive order and him talking about the executive order that he was going to issue, you know, come from a place of his deeply held religious beliefs. And, you know, I don't disagree. I believe in the traditional biblical definition of marriage myself. I voted for our state constitutional amendment a few years ago, which, of course, I was just a rank and file citizen at that time at the ballot box. But I also have several members of my family who are gay and who are in committed relationships with children. And we love them and we welcome them. And so, it, you know, for me personally, this is a difficult issue because I look at my cousins specifically and they are good people and they are productive citizens and they have great families. And this is a very difficult issue for me, both personally and politically. And so I would imagine that Governor Brownback struggles with the same thing. You know, I didn't make the statements that he made, and I'm not going to try to defend them today either, other than to say I know him to be a very good man. And while, you know, you and I may disagree with whether or not the executive order was necessary or needed, he definitely believe that it was, and But going back to your question, Sam, about, you know, Kansas being put in a negative light, it's unfortunate because it's not for the lack of trying of some individuals to make things a little bit different in Kansas. And hopefully we'll get another opportunity. Not too soon, but in the near future to make some differences.
All right, I'm dragging this one final issue directly back into secularism, and that's the Gannon School funding case. As we sit here this morning, we're awaiting a Supreme Court order about when there's going to be briefs and hearings on the three-judge panel in Shawnee County, which found block grants unconstitutional and some other things. And so I'm wondering about the pins and needles you and your colleagues must be sitting on, waiting to see what the final outcome of this case is going to be. Do you live in fear of Gannon?
I do not live in fear of Gannon. I think one thing, if you've taken the time to read the quite lengthy decision from the Douglas County panel, it's probably 90% political rhetoric. Dicta is what we call it. It means it has, you know, it's just them talking, and 10% of the actual holding. And this isn't new for that panel of judges. A few years ago, I think that they ordered this state to put it like $500 million more into public education. So the time frame, we don't know. The Supreme Court alluded to a fact of an expedited docket schedule. Right. Nobody knows what that is. So whether or not we're going to be back for a special session this year, we all certainly hope not. We've seen each other quite enough this year. But if that's necessitated by the Supreme Court's decision, we'll all roll up our sleeves and be ready to work. But do I live in fear of Gannon? I don't.
Do you think, as a as an attorney, that that school funding rightfully in this case belongs in the courts?
I do not. The funding, of education, well, any state program, right, is within, I mean, the legislative power holds that of appropriation. So now I guess the question on adequacy, it's an interesting one because on one hand they're saying Kansas children don't have an adequate access to education. On the other hand, we're ranked, I think, 8th in the United States.
Well, it depends on when you look at those rankings and which rankings that that you're looking at.
What your address is.
Fair point.
There is something about that.
Fair point, but that's true on both sides of this issue, right? The numbers, you can make numbers and statistics do whatever you want. You and I, we can probably all agree on that at least. But I believe that it's the legislative branch that holds the power of the purse. And, you know, a lot of what's happening is quite interesting with the Gannon case. You know, Kansas has had, I believe, one of the states that has most cases regarding public school education in the United States. It has always been a very important topic for us, especially in Johnson County. I've got two kids in the Olathe School District. But, you know, I go out and I look at some of the budgets at a glance that are provided by the school district. And, you know, $15,000 per student is what Olathe gets. And only about $8,000 of that goes to educational or directly educating the student. And so I do think that it begs the question, you know, what does our administrative overhead look like? And especially in Johnson County, you know, is there some efficiencies that we can find, you know, food service, you know, could all Johnson County schools contract with the same food service agency instead of having their own? I mean, I think that there are things that we can do to put more money into the classroom, which is what the block grant really does, because prior to the block grant, there were so many silos that it wouldn't matter. You know, in Olathe, I remember having a discussion of spending, I want to say, $1 million per middle school to put AstroTurf on the fields. At the same time, we were getting notices from the school, not every child would get a textbook, right? That doesn't make sense. But the reason is that they were in different silos. So the school district had money in their capital improvement silo, So they could spend that for AstroTurf.
But I believe under the block grant, you still can't move money out of a capital bond issue.
Out of the capital bond issue, that's correct.
Into the general fund.
That's correct. But we had so many. I believe the city or the district in Olathe had 8 different silos. Now we're down to 3. We have a CAPER silo, we have the capital bond and interest silo, and we have the special education silo. It does free up a lot of flexibility for districts to be able to put the money where. Getting back to what you said earlier, you know, those closest to the population that they're serving, you know, the school board now has the ability to put the money where they think it should go, outside things that citizens have voted on, like the capital bond and interest silo. Yeah.
You said you don't believe that this matter belongs in the hands of the courts, but is it not the job of the courts to interpret what the state constitution says, and is not the question of adequacy of education a constitutional issue under the Kansas Constitution?
By the way, this is what happens when you get 2 lawyers. That's my own bias, and so I apologize. But go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead and answer.
I don't disagree, but I would also say is that adequacy in the prior ruling by the Supreme Court said does not equal dollars. And that is completely opposite from what the 3-judge panel said. The 3-judge panel said adequacy is dollars. So we have the Supreme Court of Kansas saying one thing that I would agree with. It's not dollars. I mean, I am a product of a private school, private Christian school, which is a whole different thing than, just a private school, because my parents paid a lot of money. But we didn't have things like a new school building. I never had a new school building. I never had a new school desk. I probably never had a new textbook unless it was a textbook that you had worksheets within and, you know, so it wasn't left over. And my education was grand. I was always testing, you know, higher than my peers in public school. And so it does beg the question, you know, is public education using the funds wisely? And in Olathe, I think that we're doing a pretty good job. We have a very good school board. And the funding formula, I just want to make this one point. Part of the reason that the block grant was necessary was because the funding formula, especially for those counties and the districts out in western Kansas and even central Kansas, the part of the funding mechanism was your property value divided by the number of students. Well, those populations west of, you know, Shawnee County, they're declining in population, and their values of their property are probably also going down. So, for example, Blue Valley, Olathe, Shawnee Mission all got equalization dollars, all of them. Meade, Kansas, zero. I mean, there's just a fundamental issue with the funding formula as it was prior to the repeal.
Yeah, I'm just going to push back just a little bit on that. I mean, the fact is that you could have tweaked the funding formula without scrapping it, correct?
Sure, we had that option.
And fixed that, right. You had that option, and the choice was to go with block grants and no. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen in 2 years.
But I'll push back a little as well, because – especially with our budget the way that it is, having a certainty of what a dollar number is going to look like was really important. For example, last year in April of 2014, we did a teacher tenure bill. And as part of that, we did some equalization. Right. We thought we were equalizing 160 million, I think, is the number. I
think 162 was that it?
Yeah. Or? We come back, and really only a couple weeks after we passed that, the director of finance for the Department of Education came back and said, oh, wait, I was wrong on that number. It was really...
It was more.
200 and some. It not just more, but it would have eliminated our ending balance for the year 2015. So some certainty and a pause, you know, is what was done. And in all fairness, Chairman Reichman did not just take what the funding level was in 2014-2015 school year. He, you know, extrapolated that out and did provide some increases. So, is it the same funding that was under the school finance formula previously? Probably not. Is it close? Yeah, it's close. And then with the addition of extra equalization dollars that were given to some of the districts that qualified, as well as the ability for these districts now to have access to some of the silos that have previously been off limits for different spending. I'm not going to sit here and say that it's perfect, but I'm going to sit here and say that it provided us with some certainty. It provided us
when you say us, you mean the legislature.
The legislature and the budget process. The legislature and the budget process that we have to make sure that our budget balances. It provided us with the ability to say, we know for sure this X number of dollars. We can pass a tax plan and we can have some certainty. Under the prior funding formula, we did not have that. And P.S. on the bottom of that, we don't have any measure in our budget if things go over or if revenues come in below. So,
All right, we got to wrap it up, but I'm going to take one more trip around the table, get some final thoughts or a final question for Aaron. Christopher, I'll start with you.
On the subject we were just talking about, I wonder where are the voices of educators? And there may be a vehicle for educators to weigh in on this topic, but elected officials and school boards, which may or may not be experienced with education, have a place in our the structure of our society and our government and have a voice. But educators who are working with students who help kids in Christian schools and Catholic schools, like I attended, to excel and succeed, and other kids in other schools, where are they in this conversation? And are we listening to what educators know are the right things to do?
I think that's a great question. And Sam, I hope that you would have Chairman Reichman on your program to
We've
talk
asked.
About this.
So you know what? Give him a call and tell him to come.
Give him a nudge.
I'll do it because I will say this. I'm not on appropriations, so I don't know all of the intimate details, but Representative Reichman and I are fairly good friends, and so I probably have a better idea than maybe some members who aren't on appropriations. But he reached out to, I want to say, every single school district in the state of Kansas, would have lengthy conversations for hours upon hours upon hours about what their district's needs were, how the current formula was working for them and how it wasn't working for them, what a block grant would look like for their district, how it would impact them. Would they be able to make it with the same or similar funding? He did a tremendous job reaching out to those people. And some of the most active lobbyist groups within the State House are the Kansas Association of School Boards, the Kansas NEA. So they have strong voices that are there. And I don't know with prior chairman on appropriations, you know, my perspective is fairly limited, but I can tell you that Representative Reichman has done tremendous work reaching out to those school districts and finding out what do they need and how will this affect them. So I would say in this process, their voice was definitely considered and heard.
Hope so. And by the way, when you talk to Chairman Reichman, tell him we've got donuts. Dan Margulies, one
Kansas
final thought.
Yes.
Kansas donuts. Johnson County donuts, by the way. Final thought or question.
Yes. You've been in the House, the Kansas House, now for a year and a half. What, if anything, has most surprised you about the Kansas legislature?
Well, that's not hard for me to answer after this tax debate. I think the most, and maybe you'll appreciate this as an attorney, but I've never been in a negotiating position where the person or the group you're negotiating with's best case scenario is your nuclear option, and you have nothing to negotiate with. I think that has been the most surprising, seconded by a member of that group who I negotiated with for multiple hours. Ending up voting no on the bill that he was negotiating for. That's surprising to me. That's surprising.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you all very much. Christopher Leach from Merriam, my colleague Dan Margulies, thank you. I once again leave this podcast smarter than when we began it. State House Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Find us on kcur.org/statehouseblend. And every Tuesday at 11 o'clock, our friends over there on Up to Date with Steve Kraske make a little room for us. We're going to have a little State House Blend news for you in a couple of weeks, so I'll keep you up to date for that. And if you're a fan of the Twitter, and really who isn't a fan of the Twitter, you can follow me. I'm at Sam Zeff. Aaron, to get to know you just a little bit better, we end the program with your favorite song. What is it?
I knew that you were going to ask that. I don't have a favorite song. Something from Les Mis.
Anything in particular?
No, really, I like it all.
Master of the House, perhaps?
Touche.
Well, that's a fun show. That's a fun song, that's for sure.
Thus it shall be. I'm Sam Zeff. This is State House Blend. I'll see you next time.
Master of the House, doling out the charm, ready with a handshake and an open palm. Tells a saucy tale, makes a little stir. Customers appreciate the bon vivre. Glad to do a friend a favor. Doesn't cost me to be nice.